If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Wednesday, March the 13th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, the Hoover Institution's Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow. Joining me today in studio here in Hoover's Washington, D.C. office is Michael Frank. Michael Frank is a Hoover Research Fellow and Director of Hoover's Washington, D.C. program, overseeing research and outreach initiatives to promote ideas and scholarship here in the nation's capital. Prior to joining Hoover, Mike Frank served as Policy Director and Counsel for House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. He also served as Vice President of Government Relations for the Heritage Foundation. He also did a tour of duty as Communications Director for former House Majority Leader Dick Armey, and he worked for the U.S. Department of Education and the Office of National Drug Control Policy. And you're like Johnny Cash. You've been everywhere around Washington.
Can't keep a job, Bill.
Mike, a year ago on this day, Donald Trump was in San Diego doing something that delighted his base. He was talking about border wall prototypes. And that's important for Trump because the border is a huge issue for the people who sent Donald Trump to office. But meanwhile, back here in Washington, Donald Trump doesn't seem much interested in the ways of this town. And what caught my attention was the annual gridiron dinner. It's sort of a white tie event. I assume you're a swell. You go to it each year.
But nope, I've never been to one.
Never been to one. Mm-hmm. Do you want to go to one?
No.
Fine. You've been to the correspondents' dinner?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's black tie.
That's black tie.
But you haven't been to gridiron. What, alfalfa is the other one, the alfalfa club?
I've not been to that. George Shultz goes to that.
Okay. Well, you and George Shultz, you're kind of synonymous.
That's right.
Okay. Well, I mentioned gridiron, Mike, because Trump did not go to this year. And it's kind of a layup for a president. You go and you tell some jokes and you get a nice write-up in the paper. And everyone thinks, wow, what a great sense of humor the guy has. Trump didn't go. In his place went Ivanka Trump, the lovely Ivanka. What does that say about Donald Trump? He doesn't care much for Washington institutions. He doesn't seem to care much about what people who go to those events think about. And this is the question. We are now 2 years plus into Donald Trump. Is Donald Trump making Washington any Trumpian, or is Donald Trump like a guy who lives in a town but is just sort of renting a room in a hotel every night?
I think Donald Trump uses official Washington and all those sorts of black tie events as a political pinata. Mm-hmm. And he uses it because his election was in part a cultural repudiation of all things Washington, symbolized by the phrase the swamp.
Right.
And I think he just would see dinners like this and those kind of events, which are part of the annual calendar, as major events within the swamp culture, and that they're it's not worth it to him to try to take part in that. He's not going to get anything, any plaudits or any kind of advantages by wooing that crowd. They're not wooable, and given who he is,
right,
how he operates and governs. So I think he by saying no, he got the kind of press that he exactly wanted out of that.
Interesting. So this is Wednesday the 13th, and what comes to mind here is presidents and their effect on Washington. There are presidents who have monuments named for them in this town, Lincoln and Jefferson. There are presidents like Ronald Reagan who have buildings named after them, which probably maybe horrifies Ronald Reagan.
I think that's true, yes.
I always tell people when they go to Reagan Airport, that's probably the last thing Ronald Reagan wanted. But I'm sorry, but the people you worked for back in the day, they wanted to name things after Ronald Reagan, so there we have it. But there's another presidential legacy, Mike, and that's leaving people behind. And I mentioned that today because one of those people who stayed behind is going to prison for some time, Paul Manafort.
Mm-hmm.
He came here with Ronald Reagan. Other presidents do leave people behind, too. Jody Powell's a good example. Jimmy Carter only had 4 years in Washington, but Jody Powell, as press secretary the entire time, stayed behind and started a very formidable public relations operation. Plenty of Bush 41 people in town, Clinton people, Obama people. But what about Donald Trump, Mike?
Well, I think you have to think of that in two ways, as two groups. Group one would be the people who are immediately identified with the president. Mm-hmm. Maybe Kellyanne Conway, for example, Steve Miller,
right.
People of that level who are his inner circle.
Right. But Kellyanne had a thing of her own, though, before this, so she can go back to that thing of her own afterwards.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. And so, but you do have people who have become identified very prominently with Trump, and you make a good point that they didn't have a previous identity that they could fall back on. But then you have the people who were appointed and served in various agencies in the federal government under Trump,
right?
Many of whom are incredibly talented and well equipped to execute properly and advance ideas in Washington. But they again, pre-existed Trump, and they will post-exist, if that's a word, Trump, after he goes. But they're also executing his policies, and they're going to be associated with the regulatory policies or the tax cuts and the tax reforms, with maybe trade deals, with working on foreign policy and national security issues and so on, rejuvenating the military. And so I think this gives you those two groups, and, and the question becomes, do you, to the extent that the official Washington wants to layer some kind of odor on people who have a Trump affiliation, will that apply to that group? The people who are so, you know, Jim Mattis, H.R. McMaster, people of that level, are going to be, I think, independent and be evaluated separate and apart from Trump in a way, even though what they did was on his watch and under his direction.
Interesting. Let's talk about an entity that's going to be here long after Donald Trump, and that's Capitol Hill in Congress, which changed after the last election. The Republicans lost the House, so it's now a split-run operation. You've been in the House. Have you been in the House on both sides, or were you always in the House when Republicans ran the House?
I served in the minority in the 88 to 92 for a former House member from California, Bill Dannemeyer.
Okay.
And then for, like you say, Leader Dick Armey in 95, 96, and then Leader McCarthy in 2013 through 15.
Okay, so what's the old joke? I've been rich, I've been poor. Rich is a whole lot better.
Yeah.
So you went from minority to majority.
Right.
Right, but you did not go. So talk a bit about what it is to be in the majority in the House of Representatives and wake up on election day and realize, or the day after election day and realize it's over. There's obvious a shift in what office space, committee space, things like that. But what does a caucus start going through when it's in the minority?
Well, first of all, you have survival issues, like you kind of referred to office space. But there's also things such as the ratios on committees change. So there's fewer minority slots. Now, granted, there's fewer members in the caucus now that's become minority. But in many cases, it squeezes members out of committee assignments that they had fought really hard for.
Kamala Harris was looking at this in the Senate, I think. She was looking at getting bumped off judiciary at one point because they had to downsize because Republicans picked up there. So, okay, so you lose committee assignments.
And you lose the ability to set an agenda. When you're in the majority, you control the floor. You control the calendar. You when you control a committee, you, again, you control the hearing schedule, the topics of hearings. You you get to design the parameters of legislation so that you preclude for – they have concepts such as germaneness, so that in legislating, you preclude certain issues even from coming up and being considered during a the consideration of a bill by virtue of what what boundaries you've established within the draft bill. That's the majority's prerogative. And then in the House, especially because it's so large, the rules are different. The rules reflect the fact that it's a very complex – it's like a multi – you know, big intersection in the middle of Rome where everyone was trying to intersect at the same time. So you have concepts and rules. Like you can shut down the minority's ability to do anything. It's called martial law, you know, and there's nothing like that in the Senate. You can – the Senate still, even though they've been, I think, unfortunately for the nature of that body, becoming more and more like the House in the last 20 years or so. But they still have a lot more flexibility, and they reflect the fact that it's a smaller – institution, more handshake style form of governance. And so in the House, once you've lost control of that majority's, you know, control over the rules and the procedures and so on, you really do play a different role entirely.
That said, talking about rules, explain to me MTR and motion to recommit, and why is that relevant in this day and age?
Well, one thing that is, if there's anything sacred, I guess, in House rules, is the motion to recommit, which gives the minority one chance before final vote on final passage to alter the bill.
Right.
And so a lot of thought goes into what sort of final, you know, grenade you want to toss into the control room, right?
Right.
And sometimes it's just simply something they think is very politically hard to vote against, and and it's a if you're a if you're a whip in the House in the leadership in the majority, you you tell your people right up front, never vote against a rule, which is the first vote on any bill, which establishes the parameters of floor discussion, how many hours, how many amendments are in order, and what's not in order, frankly.
Right.
But and you can't vote against them on the motion to recommit because that's where the leadership the majority receives its real power. And if you and you can't sign a discharge petition is the other thing. So all those things are go toward preserving the majority's power. What the Republicans have become good at, they were very good at it the last time the Democrats had the House majority, mm-hmm. and they're doing it again, which is they offer motions to recommit that are artfully drafted in ways to divide the majority.
They did this on a gun control bill, right?
Right. The bill was going to basically suspend certain enforcement of certain drug gun laws against non-citizen illegals. Mm-hmm. And the Republicans said, why don't you apply gun control legislation to everybody, including who's in the country, including illegals.
Right.
And that divided some of their new members who are a little bit more moderate than previous groups.
Yeah, I think the Republican motion was that a legal immigrant who attempted to purchase a gun had to be reported to ICE.
Right, and that's a non-starter.
And it put Democrats sideways on that issue, what to do with ICE immigrants, what to do, and so the votes trickled away.
And the history bill, by the way, is that in the last time the Democrats had the majority, these motions to recommit prevailed something like 30-plus times.
Right.
And it really did cause some anxiety within that majority.
This has not gone unnoticed by Speaker Pelosi, and she's talked about changing mm-hmm. the ways. What do you think she's going to do?
Well, that's to further limit the motion to recommit is you're going into new territory, and that's hard to do because that's the minority's almost final chance to affect anything. You might as well not have a minority at that point.
We'll probably want them to extend the lead time of the seeing the language.
The nature of how would these things usually happen is the first shot across the bow is a little more notice, so mm-hmm. that they have time to prepare the members and whip the membership in advance. Sometimes they may say we'll pull the bill, which happens a lot.
Yeah.
But once they do that, the next step, because that may not work, is to because if they don't want to pull the bills a lot, which is the recourse to avoid the tough vote, then they have to find something more draconian. And there's other areas over the years where the rules keep getting more and more draconian in favor of the majority and against the minority. Mm-hmm. And then instead of shooting across a shot across the bow, it's right in the control room, and you're taking out the minority and taking away their ability to play a role.
Okay. How long have you been in Washington? So you go back to 88, right?
In that world, I've been here since law school, so I'm pushing the fourth decade.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That's funny. I thought you were about 30 years old. That's a shocker.
Yeah, it's despite all the gray hair.
It looks good on you. Okay. Well, I was born in this town. I was actually mm-hmm. born in Washington, D.C. I moved to California about 25 years ago. I'm a salmon, I guess. It's usually people come elsewhere into Washington, but I migrated out somehow. And I thought I used to know the town pretty well, Mike, so when I come back to the Hoover, D.C. office, I get acquainted with how things are going on. Here's what I've learned in 2019. We have to talk about AOC.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a conversation unless you somehow talk about AOC. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. You have seen a lot of people come and go on Capitol Hill, and you've been privy to a lot of leadership, and you've seen freshman congressmen come in, navigate the ways. Have you, in your political lifetime here in Washington, ever seen a freshman congressman or congresswoman come to Washington and not only get so much attention from the media, but be so damn openly defiant about mm-hmm. their own party's leadership?
No. Short answer is no.
Right.
What I have seen are freshman classes coming in and challenging the conventional rules of engagement in various ways and the mm-hmm. traditions in the institution. The Watergate class of 1974, large Democratic freshman class in the wake of the meltdown of the Nixon administration and Watergate, and they came in and challenged, for example, the power of the Rules Committee, which had Southern Democratic leadership at the time, the mm-hmm. shutdown civil rights legislation, environmental bills, you name it, and they acted independently as a separate power source from the speaker and the majority leader and so on. And they came in and created massive internal Democratic-on-Democratic violence back then. The 1994 class, 20 years later, of Republicans, first time there was a Republican majority in 40 years, the class had toppled the speaker, Tom Foley, chairman across the board, like Dan Rostenkowski, for example, and others, and they came in with guns blazing, but they were enabled by the leader, Newt Gingrich, and my boss, Dick Armey, but they operated in posses. It wasn't just one member. It was literally backdoor meetings with 6, 8, 10, 12 of them saying that they're going to challenge a rule. They're not going to vote for a rule, which mm-hmm. might be enough to topple the exercise, and unless they got their way. And then the leaders would have to talk them, you know, a little bit off a ledge and maybe negotiate something and throw some bones at them and come up with a compromise. But they didn't do it. It wasn't just one member. And the nature of the House being so large is that if you want to get anything done, you really do have to work with a group, a large enough group. Usually, if it's in the majority, figure out what your margin of leadership is. So you need 218 to pass something. If you have 228, you get 11 people together. You can topple a rule.
Right.
Right. So that's kind of your math when you think about posses. What she's doing is different because she's doing it largely by herself. She's picked up a couple of acolytes now. She has maybe a posse of three, right? But she hasn't done anything yet. In other words, once you get to the point where she may want to try to do something other than gain press and frame a debate, get a message out, beyond that kind of stuff, the soft stuff, she's going to need to have more acolytes. She's have to be able to operate with enough of a posse to say nothing's going to move on this floor unless we get something that we want substantively. And it's the substantive part that she has yet to prove.
But she has a plan, Mike. She already told us her plan, and she laid it out at a recent meeting in the caucus. Mm-hmm. How many House Republican caucuses did you sit in, Mike, where a freshman member got up and said, if you don't do things my way, I'm keeping a list, I'm going to primary you?
Well, it wasn't one member, again, but there were some. And that's
the
Freedom Caucus in the House grew out of that kind of dynamic.
Okay, then let me alter the question then. How many times did you go to a meeting where a threat was issued and it ended up in the Washington Post the next day?
Many times.
Many times.
Okay. Oh, yeah, because those meetings always leak.
They leak.
Members would record them on their phones more recently and so on. But, again, it's the substance versus the PR side of it.
Right.
And one thing that is very interesting right now, and it may be a bad omen for the Democratic majority, is there's a very strong sense that they may not even offer a budget this time. A budget is obviously it's a blueprint. You know, what you want to do relative to each agency, each program, any reforms you want to make that have budgetary effects, and you spell it out. The president has just issued his in major detail, all kinds of charts and tables and all kinds of narratives that describe it. And it becomes kind of like a party platform in a sense, but this is for a president or for a caucus within the House or the Senate. And if the majority Democrats do not offer a formal budget, I don't think that's ever happened that I know of. You have to have some kind of, you know, blueprint to guide committees and guide anybody in the House that's trying to do its job.
Okay, so how do the Democrats manage to not issue a budget and blame Donald Trump? Explain the you've done communications work. Mm-hmm. Give me the jujitsu on how you do this.
He's so poisoned the atmosphere in Washington that it's a fruitless task. It's not worth the effort, kind of what Pelosi said about impeachment the other day.
Right.
Something along those lines. And your instinct is probably correct that they'll find a way to blame the president.
What do you make of her impeachment comments? Do you think that's going to hold, or is she going to change her mind 6 months from now?
You know, a lot of people have tried to parse that one that I've noticed. But I think it'll be forgotten if there's anything of substance in the Mueller report and if they start to embark on a serious impeachment effort as opposed to trying to find plan B or plan C. That's when it plays to Trump's advantage ultimately, I think.
Well, so Jerry Nadler has gone fishing. Mm-hmm. He's issued, 80 letters to people looking for documents. So they won't be lacking for material to review, and there'll be a lot of theater. There'll be a lot of testimony. They'll probably drag Jared and Ivanka up there to testify at some point. It'll be gripping. It'll shut down the town as it goes on. But that is kind of the question. Just at what point do you make the pivot from doing all this investigating and thinking, wow, we actually have an article of impeachment with which to go for?
Yeah. Well, it's usually something that has to be a high crime and misdemeanor. I think the majority in the House just might feel it has its job done if it exposes enough kind of seamy things in the president's past.
Right.
And the interesting thing there is how much of that is going to be, if not all of it, pre-presidential in nature, even pre-candidacy in nature. Mm-hmm. So if this stuff goes back to, you know, 2010 or 2005 or periods like that, then the question becomes, is this really an impeachable, you know, category of things to go after. And if there's nothing relating to the arguments about conspiring with the Russians, then you're in different territory and they have a different communications challenge, and they have to deal with their base differently.
Right. I look at Speaker Pelosi, Mike, and I wonder if she kind of feels like she's running a daycare center. And this is kind of like just letting your kids run around wild for an hour in daycare until they just exhaust themselves. And maybe that's your strategy for impeachment. Just let them get their yayas out. Let them investigate him. Let them try to humiliate him. It'll make their bases happy, and you know they'll let it go.
I said that once to Speaker Boehner after a meeting with a group of members who were making a principal case that a House majority single-handedly could overcome a Senate majority and a president of the other party to repeal the president's signature bill, the Obamacare bill. And I said, Mr. Speaker, you really should have gotten an advanced degree in childhood education because this makes no sense. And I think she's facing the same kind of profound naivete mm-hmm. and kind of deer in the headlights expressions among these members, but they're shameless. They're just going out and there's a level of self-confidence in what they're saying and doing that is mind-boggling to them, because you know people like Pelosi have been members like her and Steny Hoyer, the majority leader, mm-hmm. have been in Congress for decades.
Right.
And they've seen a lot of things come and go, and they have a lot of scars to show for it. And they're coming in looking at these, they have to refer to them behind closed doors as kids, I have to imagine. So it's a generational thing, but attitudinal. And don't forget that AOL came to prominence because she defeated a very high-ranking member of the Democratic House leadership, and Joe Crowley. And he was, in a lot of people's minds, a future speaker.
Mm-hmm.
She has no fear. In fact, I think she, again, kind of like Trump in the pinata analogy to official Washington, the Democratic leadership to her is her political pinata. Mm-hmm. And she's going after it, and it enhances her reputation. It probably enhances the number of people that follow her and like her and on social media and so on. Every time she takes a shot at them, and now, you know, Congresswoman Omar and the woman from Michigan as well mm-hmm. are finding that's a pretty good formula. And I think they're doing that day to day as well.
I think the Democratic Trump is a great analogy here because she has the same effect on Republicans that Trump has on Democrats, in that you just see her on TV and she's polarizing and she thrives on disruption and social media and so forth and just seems fearless about the place. Mm-hmm. Did you ever think you'd live to see the day when John Boehner was selling marijuana?
No.
Let me amend that. He's not on the street dealing, but he is in the greater business of cannabis. No stranger to rolled up products, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But tobacco.
Right.
But
exactly.
But no, here he is. He's in a brave new world of cannabis. How about that?
There was a constant cloud of smoke in the speaker's office back then. He was a serious, probably still is, a serious chain smoker.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, so there was a green agenda out there for Republicans.
Right.
Right. AOC, so where is she headed? I'm thinking Neil Young and better to burn out than it is to rust, right? But I actually have this fun wager with some friends. Who's going to be in Washington longer, Donald Trump or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez?
I mean, there's a side of this that makes you think of the meteor analogy.
Yes.
And it'll burn out perhaps in quick time, and she'll become a trivia question at some point.
Mm-hmm.
But by the same token, if you look at polls about young people, she is rhetorically and in some sense substantively tapping into something that's going on, which is the increasing acceptance, whether it's, I hesitate to say substantive acceptance, but I think a lot of it is the branding of socialism as being cool and hip and something you can get behind, even if they don't quite understand what it might mean to them and their families and their communities. But that's what she's tapping into. And she's not an isolated person with one voice. She's not like a Ron Paul out there, right? He was a very isolating guy, and he had a small contingent of people and gold bugs and whatever.
Right.
She's tapping into something a lot more a lot larger and I think a lot more ominous in a sense to markets and to freedom.
I think there are a couple of things. One is obviously the issue she's talking about. There is a generation out there that wants to hear these issues, but I think you stumbled on something very important. You saw it's Obama too. There's a lot of style going on here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just kind of a hipness. So it's being both woke. God, I hate that word woke, but it keeps getting used. But woke, social awareness to problems, but also the way she'll clap back at people and dismiss people and so forth. And again, this is like Trump. When Trump does things that are just so gaudy or just brunt or just unpresidential, and that base of his, they love the fact that he's being that way. And here she is doing things that are I've never heard this word, but uncongressional, if there's such a concept or such a word, mm-hmm. but she's doing the same thing. But again,
But she's doing right. something important, too, that I think if the conservative side of the spectrum is on it here, mm-hmm. can really take advantage of it and educate the country in a way.
What's that?
She's offering up and creating a need for having a basic discussion. What is socialism? Mm-hmm. What is capitalism, free enterprise? Right. Where does it fit into a democratic system? The basic questions. And to the extent that, you know, when Trump offered that one line in the State of the Union, let's resolve tonight to not ever let America become a socialist nation. Mm-hmm. And then he gave his subsequent speech 2 or 3 weeks later in Miami to a basically Hispanic audience of refugees from Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela,
right.
and their you know, families and neighbors. I never saw him have a crowd in his hand, eaten out of his hand the way that audience was. Mm-hmm. And he's taking that one line from his State of the Union and riffing on that for probably half an hour. And it was creative, and it was smart, and it was the best I've ever seen him. And you know, he has a certain, you know, unique style, but this is a softball, this kind of issue,
right.
for someone like him, but for any elected Republican. So to the extent that this can become a referendum on whether socialism is a viable and positive path forward for America in the wake of electricity going out and people losing their dialysis machines in Venezuela.
Right.
You know, that's a... It's an incredible opportunity to relearn the basics that have maybe not been taught at universities.
Right, but she's done something else. She has created the first primary of the democratic system, and that's the AOC primary.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So she comes out with the Green New Deal, and as a presidential candidate, you got to decide, am I with her or not? And you saw, what, about 5 or 6 mm-hmm. of them immediately jump through the hoop and endorse
right.
it. And now they have to live with the consequences.
Mm-hmm.
In all your time in the House, Mike, did you ever put out a document as sloppy as that, just in terms of what got out?
If I did, I wouldn't acknowledge that.
You wouldn't have a job, probably.
Right,
still.
Exactly.
But no, you had to be, having mm-hmm. worked on the Hill, you had to be kind of shy. I mean, it really did look mm-hmm. like a high school production.
Yeah, and they had to pull it, and they had to revise it and so on and edit it down. But it's also, that's a refreshing thing in a way, because to the extent that the models indicate the planet's going to come to an end in a time certain, then what is it you're willing to do to try to stop that from happening? And this is an honest effort, you know, and the ugliness of it for mm-hmm. the average person's daily life is something that has to be out there. And she's, in her own kind of blunderbuss way, mm-hmm. started that discussion.
Right. So I started the week back at Stanford in Palo Alto doing a podcast with your colleague Adam White, mm-hmm. normally in this D.C. office, and we talked about Chief Justice Roberts. And what I wanted to find out from Adam was if he agreed with my theory that if I came to Washington and I want to pay respects to the most influential person in town right now, I would go to the court and say hi to the chief. Why? Because matters that get tied up in Congress with this presidency seem to end up in the court. And if they're very complicated political matters, and probably the border wall is headed in this direction, it ends up in the lap of the Supreme Court. And there's Chief Justice more times than not as the fifth vote in a 5-4 decision, sometimes to Kurt Serve's dismay, as with the liberal side.
Mm-hmm.
So is John Roberts the most influential / powerful man in Washington right now? Is it the guy in the big White House a couple blocks from here? Is it the new Speaker of the House? Is it Mitch McConnell? Is it Jeff Bezos? Is it somebody I'm missing?
I'd say it's President Trump.
Still Donald Trump.
See, I think the and Adam is an expert on this. You can do an entire show just on this whole point. Mm-hmm. In the separation of powers, I think the executive branch now is well beyond in control. I mean, if it's supposed to be one-third between the Congress, the executive branch, meaning the president, and the courts, the president probably is at 50% or so of that 100%. And the other two branches split the remaining 50, maybe it's even less mm-hmm. for them. And so on a day-to-day basis, we saw the kind of things that President Obama could do unilaterally, many of which I argue were unconstitutional. Trump, to some extent, can do that. I don't think he should. I don't think he should do unconstitutional things.
I have a pen and I have a phone.
Right.
Right.
And what it meant was that you can interpret statutes in very robust and unforeseen ways to do whatever you want to do when you want to do it from mm-hmm. a regulatory standpoint.
Right.
The difference, of course, is that President Trump does have people within the agencies that'll push back on him
mm-hmm.
quietly. They'll leak. They'll do other things.
Right.
Obama really didn't have that. But to the extent that on a day-to-day basis, you have all kinds of, you know, one of the problems Congress has had over the last 30, 40 years is they punt on the substantive resolution of certain tough issues mm-hmm. when passing legislation. So they say they give that discretion to the leading executives in the Department of Labor or Transportation or HHS and so on. That's an enormous ceding of authority mm-hmm. to the executive branch, and they can take full advantage of that. We've already seen them do quite a bit in the area of the Affordable Care Act, and they're going to do a lot more. And they do it on energy policy, environmental policy, because there's so much kind of open-endedness in how Congress passed these laws, and it just sits right in the lap, falls right into the lap of the agencies. And the courts, because of something called the Chevron Doctrine, have a predisposition to defer to the authority and expertise of all these people who work in the executive branch. So both chambers have ceded a lot of their authority, as envisioned in the Constitution, to the president and his appointees in the agencies. And that's why I think he's still the most powerful person.
So in a regard, it's his town, but getting back to our original question, it's not really his town. He's still a New Yorker. He's still a Floridian. He's just biding his time. No, well, not Joe Biden, but he's here for
right.
He's here for 4 years. Comedians say I'm here all week. Somebody I didn't mention in the influential players in Washington was Kevin McCarthy, your old mm-hmm. boss. Let's talk about him for a couple of minutes because he's now the minority leader, no longer the majority leader. What situation does he face right now?
Well,
but let's talk about it also in terms mm-hmm. of who Kevin McCarthy is, because the perception of Kevin McCarthy, it's a man who's long on relationships. I don't know if the story is true, but it's always put in there that he puts the photos up on the wall of members and changes them periodically to make sure everybody's happy. Mm-hmm. So he's great on relationships. Mm-hmm. He'll show up, he'll fundraise for you. But he's not Paul Ryan. He's not a policy wonk.
Right. He doesn't hold himself out to be a policy wonk.
Right.
He has very good radar, very good instincts on that front. Mm-hmm. And he his management style was always to defer to the chairman. Right. On the substance. So he gave the chairman a lot of authority, sort of like if you're a CEO and you want to give the vice presidents in your different divisions the ability to get their jobs done, and mm-hmm. that's what he wanted to do. In contrast, someone like Newt Gingrich would form a task force in some policy area
right.
and bring in a bunch of members, only one or two of whom might actually be on the committee of jurisdiction, and mm-hmm. anger the members who were on the committee because
right.
suddenly they'd have this group of outsiders making policy. They thought that was their job.
Right.
So Kevin was very, very good at finding the right lines of authority and coming together and taking the advice and the judgment call mm-hmm. of those leaders. He's in his new role, when you're the minority leader, first and foremost, you want to keep your troops together. And if a new majority comes in, and the easiest thing for the minority leader is when the new majority comes in and overreaches.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened in 2009 and 10, for example.
Right.
Especially when you had unified Democratic rule. It happened in many cases to Clinton's advantage in 95, 96, when the House Republican majority came in and even was, appalling the Senate majority of Republicans at the time, Bob Dole and company, with very, very ambitious legislative changes, entitlement law changes, tax cuts, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's easy to keep everybody pulled together. You can keep, and you may lose your votes, but what you've done is you've unified your party, and you give yourself sort of a script to go forward in the upcoming election.
Right.
And so, to the extent that the House Republicans cannot engage in divisiveness and divisive fights, and let that all happen on the majority side, and do things like what we said earlier, talk about the motions to recommit as a tool to define who they are and who we are, meaning who Republicans are and who the Democrats are,
right.
That'll make going into this next election cycle that much easier. It'll be easier to recruit candidates, be easier to define what they stand for in ways that'll maybe bring back a block or two different blocks of voters who were lost, for example, the suburban mm-hmm. voters in many regions of the country that went for a Democratic House candidate.
Right.
So it's that kind of role. The last thing you want to do is preside over a fractious minority.
Right.
That's lose-lose.
That minority has gone from – the minority is now less than 200 seats, right? It's gone from majority of about
right.
240 to under 200 now. So the good news, fewer rooms to get the Greenbrier when you do your retreat. But mm-hmm. what about that smaller – is it more homogenic? Is it more –
It's more Trumpian.
More Trumpian, right, because a lot of suburban Republicans
got lost.
Tossed, right?
If you think of the members incumbent Republicans who lost,
right.
plus the incumbent Republicans who retired, they were largely replaced either by Democrats or by more Trumpian Republicans. And so to the extent that you ask, is this Donald Trump's Republican Party, it's certainly true in the House of Representatives. And when you look at I'll give you an example. I like to study congressional districts. The split between the Democrats and Republicans on different measures of elitism and affluence, okay, is almost perfect at this point. The one example that jumps out is if you look at the, I think it's the 100 congressional districts with the highest median home value, right? I think 96 of those now have Democrats in them.
This is going to be California, New York, and a few small pockets of Florida.
And one of the four Republicans in that top 100 is Duncan Hunter, who's indicted.
Right.
So he may, who knows, right?
Right, from San Diego.
Yeah. So and the same kind of dynamic is true for households with incomes of $200,000 and above, with households that have people with graduate school degrees, things like that. It's so overwhelmingly now in favor of the Democratic Party. Before, instead of being 96, it might have been low 80s. It was still a lot. But maybe 15, 18 of those seats that flipped were these districts that have very high home values, high levels of education and income, and lower levels of manufacturing employment, fewer people who served in the military, things like that. And so this party now that Trump is in charge of is much more a party of the middle in all those different kinds of ways of measuring things.
Right. Well, Kevin McCarthy comes from Bakersfield, California, which is a world of difference from Duncan Hunter's San Diego. But is Kevin McCarthy Trumpian? I don't view him as Trumpian. He's certainly not Trumpian in demeanor.
He's very when I first met him and started working for him, I was thinking he was more in the mold of a Jack Kemp, more in the mold of a Paul Ryan, for example. But he's he knows his district. He knows enough about Trump. And don't forget, Trump kind of was a blank slate in many ways on policy. He decided he wanted to be a Republican, I think, before he figured out what that meant in terms of policy. And he'd been a New Yorker for his life in terms of his political engagement. You know, going to the Clintons' wedding was not by accident, right? And so I think he was willing to, and he has, if you look at the substance of what the agencies and the appointees have done, his court appointments and so on, he's governed very much, I'd say 75-85% the way any conservative Republican president would in this in this day and age. So I think he saw that as the opportunity. And he was, at the time, first 2 years, he's in charge of the floor in the House, being the majority leader. So he was able to help shepherd through as much as possible of what the president was trying to accomplish, especially on things like the tax bill. He played an instrumental role in making sure that there were no mishaps on the House as that went forward.
Interesting. Donald Trump will pay a lot of attention to the Senate because the Senate's the home to judicial nominations. So that's a huge part of the Trump legacy. I don't think people appreciate that much. Adam and White and I were talking about this. I think Trump, by the time he is done, if he keeps up this pace, he could have nominated something like one out of every four or one out of every three federal judge in this country. He's just, thanks to the rule changes and his interest in this and the one area where his White House is very organized, to go back to AOC, they have a list. They are churning out judges, and the House doesn't. So what interest does Donald Trump really have in the House of Representatives?
Well, you know, for...
Other than impeachment.
Yeah. Well, I don't think anybody is in the mindset that in this particular Congress, meaning in 2019 and 2020, that we're going to pass any monumental legislative achievements.
Right.
So, again, where's the action going to be? It's where you can control it.
Right.
When they took the vote threshold for judicial confirmations down to simple majority in the Senate, which Harry Reid did a number of years ago for everybody but the Supreme Court, and then Mitch McConnell did it a couple years ago for the Supreme Court, that now gives a Senate majority unilateral ability, if they stick together, to confirm judges.
Right.
And so they're going to do that. I heard the other day that in spite of having confirmed over 80, I think, judges thus far at all levels, there's more openings on the bench now than there was when Trump came in. So, I mean, there's an astonishing fertile ground there for him to go forward. And there was another round of circuit court judges confirmed today, as I understand it. Naomi Rao, for example, in the DC circuit.
Yeah.
Right. So, and Adam White's predecessor, the other job that he has at George Mason, at Scalia Law School, by the way. So they can do that. And they can do a lot of things in the regulatory arena unilaterally with existing authorities. And beyond that, they simply have to kind of pass a budget. They're not going to do anything to – the budget's not going to include any kind of major changes. There's not going to be any big deal. Now, right. You know, if interest rates start spiking and all of a sudden the interest on the debt increases by $150 billion all at once, maybe there'll be enough of a political impetus to cut a deal somehow on mm-hmm. entitlements on the budget. But I don't see that, unless it's forced on them, happening anytime soon.
Let me throw a crazy theory at you, Mike, uh-huh. and that Donald Trump needs Nancy Pelosi.
Mm-hmm.
Speaker Hoyer is just not the same foil. Donald Trump thrives on foils, and he had a great one in Hillary Clinton,
mm-hmm.
and he's been looking for one ever since Hillary, and he gets, you know, he gets nicknames for people, and he finds people to pick on. She's prime material for him. Nancy mm-hmm. Pelosi, she comes already ready as a foil, built in, baked in. And you were talking about this before we mm-hmm. came on the air, that right. dealing with Nancy Pelosi is a world of difference than dealing with Steny Hoyer.
Steny Hoyer is the House Majority Leader. He's from Maryland. Yeah. He's sort of an old school backslapping and very effective legislator. He's been in office forever. And the interesting thing is Pelosi and Hoyer were, I think, pages together way back in the day or something like that. And they don't like each other from what I'm told. Pelosi's ideological, and she's vicious when it comes to going after people middle to right on the political spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing is, and I think we see this with her dealings with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, is that she doesn't push back in the same way when she's being pushed from her left. And that's her weakness. That's her Achilles heel. And I think it's showing up in fairly dramatic fashion right now. All the more reason for President Trump to take advantage of that and to make her look even weaker than she in fact is. But don't forget that AOL is another foil for Trump. And to the extent that she, through the media, becomes the personification of House Democrats, Trump will take advantage of that as well.
Okay, final question, Mike. The Ides of March approacheth. Friday is the Ides of March, March 15th. Who in Washington should be worried about the Ides of March right now? Is it Nancy Pelosi and AOC? Is it Donald Trump and Republican senators running for cover in 2020? Is it Jeff Bezos and the media? Who in this town should be worried right now?
Well, you know, you're talking about a city where the major institutions have approval ratings in the tank, every single one of them.
You talk about a race to the bottom between mm-hmm. politics, media, lobbying.
Mm-hmm. And different branches of government, they're all at lowest levels in a long time.
Exactly.
So you're talking about maybe it's the overall city and culture of Washington, like we discussed at the outset. Mm. Because there's something, nothing is happening in Washington that is enhancing the reputation of any part of Washington. So it's sort of like your body being plagued by multiple diseases simultaneously, and it's a race to see which one it is that terminates you. It's not a pretty place to be these days.
So we should be hailing the genius of Bryce Harper, then, is what you're telling me.
He got to Philadelphia, which who would have thought?
So Philadelphia is more desirable than Washington, is what you're telling me.
Yeah, you know, I was actually one that was happy to see him go because I think the team's better without him, but that's a separate discussion when you do your sports show.
Yes. All right, so the Ides of March, you think Washington writ large is...
Writ large as a city, as sort of a complex of institutions, as a kind of an entity in the minds of the average American, it needs to somehow find ways to rehabilitate itself.
Okay. Mike Frank, I enjoyed the conversation.
Same here, Bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word and convince your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Mike Frank and his Hoover colleagues to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. Is Mike Frank on Twitter?
No.
No. But you can find
That's why I'm sane.
Yes, but you can find Mike Frank at Washington Nationals games this spring and summer. He'll be the guy smiling because there's no number 34 in right field. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on all major podcast platforms, including Apple, Google, Podbean, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Spotify. I'm Chris Dower for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.